This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U-Mobile.
Good morning, I'm Shazana Mokhtar, and this is the Best of the Breakfast Grill for 2021. This week, we're revisiting interesting and important conversations that we've had on the show throughout the year. We started the year with one of the most recognizable and perhaps controversial names in Malaysian politics, former Prime Minister Tun Dr. Mahathir Mohamad. Having resigned as the Prime Minister of Malaysia after the controversial Sheraton move, which unseated the Pakatan Harapan government in 2020, he went on to start a new Malay-based party, Berjuang. Noel Lim spoke to Mahathir in January to get his thoughts on the future of politics in Malaysia and his legacy.
Today, whole governments can be bought, and people with money and bad intention can buy a government and govern this country. Just imagine a government of this country which is corrupt. And what will they do? They will be even more corrupt when they have power. This is what Perjuang is all about. We will not be able to form the government. We know we are a small party, but we want to fight to eradicate corruption. Is that bad? I will not work with people who are charged in court for crimes, whether they have been found guilty or not. These people know they are guilty. It would be a sad day when the whole world knows people have stolen money and the court says, no, they have not stolen. It will be a sad day for our judiciary. I don't care about my legacy. I don't care. I'm quite sure when I'm dead and gone, people will run me down and all that. It's not important. I'll be dead anyway. What legacy?
That was former Prime Minister and President of Perjuang, Tun Dr. Mahathir Mohamad. A surprising twist for 2021 was Tan Sri Muhyiddin Yassin's resignation as Prime Minister after losing support from many UMNO MPs due to the government's handling of the pandemic and the economy. The race was on in late August to determine who the next Prime Minister was going to be. Wong Xiaoning had a panel discussion with Dr. Bridget Walsh, Honorary Research Associate of Nottingham University, Malaysia, and Jahabar Sadiq, Editor-in-Chief of the Malaysian Insight, on these developments.
So in this particular configuration, there are two different leaders that were among the PN. The first is Ismail Sabri, and the second is Hishamuddin Hussein. These are the two actors, two individuals that become listed. And then they're able to basically cobble the numbers of the existing coalition plus the different actors. It is most likely, however, that the king will turn to alternatives, because keep in mind that the PN as a group lost its majority. And it's not that they only lost the majority. One has to keep in mind that it's public pressure that has really transformed the situation. This is an elite crisis, and elites have pulled out of a relationship with each other, but they have only been able to do it because of public pressure about the failing in terms of managing COVID-19 and the economy so far. So I think this is one group. The second group, of course, is Anwar Ibrahim and Pakatan Harapan, plus, depending on whether or not Warisan and others are part of it. This particular group has core numbers. They are saying that they also include the traditional opposition numbers. Whether or not that is actually true or not, and whether or not is not so clear. But so far, no one has denied it. They are projecting that they're almost at 105 at this particular point. I think that's probably higher than it actually is. And then the third group is more driven by UMNO. These include Zahid Hamidi, as well as those what I call the party protectors, people who feel that BNPN was actually, and Muhyiddin was undermining the UMNO. And so we see a situation where in that group, it's Tunku Razali, in particular, who has been seen as their alternative, their candidate in that group.
Jahaba, I want to bring you into this conversation. What do you think UMNO's chances are, though? Especially Dato' Sri Ismail Sabri. Do you think he has a chance?
Well, I think Ismail Sabri's chances are a bit dim right now, for the simple reason he had that infamous press conference at the City Hall auditorium and basically thumbed his nose at his own party. He is being touted as the Prime Minister with Hamzah Zainuddin as deputy. And Hamzah Zainuddin was the Home Minister that was trying to needle and sort of coerce UMNO into a pliant position with Bersatu and the PN government. So I think Ismail Sabri does not have the the blessings of his party to be the prime minister unless he can offer a fair bit of concessions to UMNO as it is.
That was Dr. Bridget Welsh, Honorary Research Associate at the Nottingham University of Malaysia, and Jahabar Sadiq, Editor-in-Chief at the Malaysian Insight. Another turning point in Malaysian politics was the 15th Malacca state election. Due to an unsuccessful attempt to change the Chief Minister of Malacca when four errant members of the Malacca Assembly pulled support from the incumbent state government, a snap election was called. The election became a three-cornered fight between Barisan Nasional, Perikatan Nasional and Pakatan Harapan. BN won a landslide two-thirds majority, and Shaoning spoke to Ibrahim Sufian, Program Director of Merdeka Centre, and Dr. Bridget Welsh, Honorary Research Associate of University of Nottingham, Malaysia, about the lessons learned from the Malacca elections.
It's quite surprising that, you know, before this election, we thought that with the split of the Malays, then Pakatan Harapan could take advantage by continuing to retain strong support from the non-Malay vote base that they've always enjoyed. But I think what the results show is that not only did the non-Malay votes didn't come back in large enough numbers, but they lost more Malay support from what was already a low base. So in terms of Malay support for UMNO, I think the glancing through the results, we have not done detailed analysis yet, but we do notice that I think UMNO marginally declined support from Malays. Perhaps in 2018, they enjoyed about 54-55% Malay support. We think now it's about 50%. They were able to win partly because their base showed up. Their base showed up to vote. But I think what's also worrying is that looking at some of the saluran details, we noticed that a bigger portion of the younger Malay voters actually voted for PAS and Bersatu in certain parts of the state. So I think when we look at the overall numbers, we have UMNO winning about 21 seats with just about 36% of the popular vote. So this is really interesting, somewhat like Justin Trudeau winning the Canadian elections with 33% of the vote.
And Bridget, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, my initial analysis shows that UMNO lost Malay support of about 4%.
Okay.
But most of the Malay support went to Bersatu, but some of that to PAS and some particular seats, which they gained almost 17% of Malay support. So the Malays didn't come back to UMNO, especially young Malays. UMNO just managed to get its traditional political base, and that was enough for it to win. But the Malays, many of the Malay voters, especially younger Malays, moved towards Bersatu.
They also talked about PKR's terrible loss.
For PKR, they lost significant support after the departure of the Malay wing of the party by Azmin Ali last year, and also the collapse of the coalition with Bersatu took away a sizable chunk of the Malay support that was previously enjoyed by PKR. So I think what is left with PKR, the result that we see from PKR could stem from two or three points. One is that they suffered a significant decline in terms of what was already a very small amount of Malay support in the party. So I think that support is now probably half of what they enjoyed in 2018. So they're probably around 14%, 13% thereabouts. There is also some pushback from ethnic Chinese voters on account of some specific seats. Perhaps in terms of candidate choices, we do know that a lot of voters were not happy that they took on the defectors from, you know, the Malacca state government prior to during the nomination period. And then finally, this election is one where, you know, the typical campaign methods were prohibited. So it really depressed turnout. And it, I think, robbed the opposition overall of the chances to mobilize and fire up their loyal base to show up and vote.
I think the first issue is leadership. I think Anwar Ibrahim has lost credibility among large sections of the electorate, and he as the leader of the opposition, and also as a leader within PKR. The party itself has suffered from its deep factionalism, the purging of many different of its members. Its machinery is very weak. You know, it is a lot of its wounds are self-inflicted. You know, they remove, for example, Ginny Lim from Machap Jaya, which was a, you know, it just basically, they lost a seat. seat, but in the way that they chose their candidates. The factionalism in the party was quite serious. They've lost what is seen as the reform credentials when they took in the frogs. And, of course, they have an MOU that makes them just like everybody else in terms of UMNO and Bersatu. And so as a consequence, what PKR stands for really is not necessarily clear to the electorate. And I think we see that in what happened in the results.
That was Dr. Bridget Walsh, Honorary Research Associate of the University of Nottingham, Malaysia, and Ibrahim Sufyan, Program Director of the Merdeka Center. We'll have more highlights from conversations on The Breakfast Grill in 2021 after these messages. Stay with us, BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
Welcome back to the Best of The Breakfast Grill 2021. I'm Shazana Mokhtar. Today, we're revisiting conversations on Malaysian politics, and we're now diving into the 12th Sarawak state elections, where Khoo Soo Chuang spoke to Dr. Arnold Puyo, political analyst, and Dr. Dayang Afizah Awang Marikan, economics professor, both from University Malaya Sarawak, about the wealth gap and development issues in East Malaysia.
You see, when we talk about development, right, when you go to the rural area, they're like leaders, they're like candidates who can basically not just talk about development, but who can translate development into something that is tangible. And if you talk to the rural people, they're like leaders who can talk about development, right? About a road connection, about electricity. But can you really do it in a short span of time? If you can deliver something that is tangible, something that can be seen in a short span of time, then you will get, there are more chances for you to be elected. This is the priority of the rural people, and this is something that they really, really, really want. I'm not saying that they don't care about economic planning. I don't say that they really don't understand about poverty and all that. But for them, what is important is tangible development, something that they can really see. So it's not just about rhetorics.
Can I add to what Dr. Arnold is saying, that, I mean, if you go to the rural people, you're not talking about the budget. You're not talking about the 12th Malaysia plan. They don't know that. But basically, if you are able to show that you can bring the skill to the rural, for example, like what we did, we're doing the fertigation, chili fertigation for the rural, trying to enhance their skill in a way that can show that our effort actually to increase the income of the people. So how? But when you're talking about poverty, it's not just looking at the income. When you're talking about poverty, it's more than income that we're looking at. We're talking about the skill enhancement, and we're talking about the key area, for example, the health, the education, and as well as the socioeconomics. This is what it is being mentioned in the Multidimensional Poverty Index, MPI. So it's not just the income that we are looking. Talking about income is way, way back already. We are talking way forward, which is more than that, which most important thing is the skill development. If you can translate this idea to the people, especially rural people, and they understand that they're actually, you are actually really serious wanting to increase their standard of living, increase their health, for example, and education. In Sarawak, the education, I would say, in terms of the students, I can give you some statistics here. The low educational attainment and insufficient skill among the Borneo states. Now we are Borneo states, and we are not the East Malaysian. According to 2019 household income and basic amenity survey, the composition of Sabah and Sarawak skilled workers only comprise about 14% and 20%.
Arnold also explained the significance of the Malaysia Agreement 1963, or MA63, in the interview.
You see, when we talk about MA63, right, I think the issue here is the details. When you talk about devolution of power, what is it that you want Sarawak to have? Do you want Sarawak to have more power in terms of decision-making? What area of decision-making that should be given back to Sarawak and things like that? But I think, as I mentioned to you earlier, much progress has been done. Power is slowly being decentralized to the state. But I think progress is better in Sarawak compared to in Sabah.
Of course, the MA63 has now been passed in Parliament, and the incumbent state government coalition, Gabungan Parti Sarawak, or GPS, won the state elections by a big margin. During the interview, Chuang discussed the popularity of the coalition with Arnold and Dayang.
I'm not saying this because I'm a supporter of GPS. Well, I think in terms of maintaining Sarawak's autonomy, they've been able to do that. They've been able to put pressure on Petronas, for instance, to pay 5% tax on petroleum products. They managed to uplift English as the official language of Sarawak alongside Bahasa Malaysia. What they have to do more, I think, is to address the issue that the overlapping of jurisdiction between the federal and state agencies. I think Dr. Dayak has a different take on this.
Is that true?
Yeah, I would say that in terms of development, even though we see a lot of development, you know, here and there, but I would say there's still a lot of things that need to be done for Sarawak. There's a lot of things need to be done, despite that we are actually trying to achieve the 2030 high-income countries and we are aiming about 8% to be there, you know, 8% of income economic growth to be there. Those who, I'm not, as what as Dr. Arnold say, that I'm not a supporter of any here, but the one that I can see the closest that can, you know, bring us there is the one that GPS, because they, you need to have the money to do all this development. And as what as our CM says, that our development monthly for the next year will be like about 1 billion. They can do that, you know, for the development. I mean, if you don't have such an allocation, you cannot bring Sarawak.
That was Dr. Arnold Puyo, political analyst, and Dr. Dayang Afizah Awang Marikan, economics professor, both from University Malaya Sarawak. 2021 also saw the gazettement and implementation of Undi 18, as well as automatic voter registration on December 15th, which will now open Malaysia to about 5.8 million new voters. Prior to that, for an International Youth Day special, Roshan Kanisen spoke to Kira Yusri, co-founder of Undi 18, about how the youth might vote in the coming elections.
Studies by Merdeka Center has showed that young people tend to vote beyond racial lines. I mean, they are able to see beyond racial politics to a certain extent, in a sense where like they are able to they care more about policies. I'm not saying that they will all agree on the same policies, but they will prioritize policies in terms of making a decision on who they want to vote for. And I would say this probably because young people reside mostly in urban areas where you are able to, you know, you move out of like homogeneous communities and you have a bit more diversity in terms of how you integrate into society. And universities and schools play a big role in that, right? And also even places of work, because even in terms of like tertiary education, less than half of Malaysians actually get to go to university. And even if you break it down demographically, right, like looking at numbers and all that, you have urban youth, you have rural youth, you have rural youth from conservatives and progressive backgrounds and things like that. And I think, however, what young people are also more exposed to is social media. Social media can change or affirm your beliefs, I'm sure, as you know. And I think because of that, we're able to see beyond racial politics. You know, sometimes I think what Malaysia's politics traditionally we're used to is like tying our politics to certain individuals or to certain parties, right? But nowadays, you see that political parties are also trying to diversify the representatives they put forward because they understand that as times change, people want more than just someone who looks like me. You know, people want more than just like, you know, this is the uncle that came to the kenduri lah, to the funeral lah, to everything, right? So I think when with new politics, you know, you can see, especially even parties like DAP, right, they put very diverse young candidates forward. You see the rising of new political parties like MUDA. Even PSM is going online and trying to be more social media savvy because they know that's what young people are looking for. And with social media now, young people, we can hold our politicians to accountable very easily. Politicians, you have to be more receptive towards young people. And whether young people believe in this or that, whether they believe in UBI or free education or abolishing loans or whatever, the fact is they know what they want.
That was Kira Yusri, co-founder of Undi 18. And speaking of the youth vote, one cannot ignore MUDA, which is due to be registered as a political party today after the KL High Court ruled in favour of the party, which had been seeking for the government to register it as a political party since September 2020. Wong Xiaoning spoke to the party founder, YB Said Sadiq, before the court's decision about the appeal of MUDA.
I want MUDA to be the party of the future, and that means really disrupting
Malaysian politics and focusing not just on the politics of multiracialism and diversity, but a more policy-based approach. And for MUDA to be successful, it cannot be personality-based. We must ensure that it becomes very much driven by ideology and policy platforms. And that's why I see today, especially in Malaysia, I think the appetite among young Malaysians is not based on personality alone. That's where you see prior to, during last election, young voters voted in one way, but after election, when there were some policy platforms which we failed to deliver, they shifted very quickly. Mm. We showed that young voters are very dynamic in nature. And with that, I'm very sure they don't want to merely have personality changes or cosmetic changes to policies. They want to see Malaysia to become a developed country. They want to see our education to be one of the best in the world. They want to see the cost of living to be managed well. They want affordable housing. They want to ensure that corruption levels can be reduced. They want to ensure a democratic system which is truly representative and not a system in which power is centralized to the hands of the few. So on that path, in order for us to unleash Malaysia's true potential, it's not merely about making cosmetic personality changes. It's really about overhauling public policy discussions and public policies in Malaysia so that we lock in those changes and ideally we get a system in which even though government, prime ministers can change 10 times every year, but the system is strong enough to build Malaysia a country which is future-proofed.
That was YB Said Saddiq, founder of MUDA. That caps our retrospective of interviews on Malaysian politics. You can listen to all the conversations featured today via podcast on the BFM app or on our website, bfm.my. This has been the Best of the Breakfast Grill 2021. BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile. Unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.